Hello and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. Each week we hear from the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance, taking you beyond the numbers and the hype and getting to the heart of the big issues of the day. This week we're going to meet another of the remarkable and inspirational thought leaders at the forefront of innovation that UBS supports and celebrates through its Global Visionaries programme. This time it's the turn of an extraordinary man with a truly remarkable story, Mark Pollock. After losing his sight in 1998, aged just 22, Mark became an ultra-endurance athlete, becoming the first blind adventurer to race to the South Pole. In 2010, however, Mark suffered another devastating blow when a fall from a window broke his back, leaving him paralysed. Mark joins us now to share his story and to tell us more about his latest and arguably greatest expedition yet, to find a fast-track cure for paralysis. Mark Pollock, thanks for being on the programme. I wanted to kind of start off by asking you about the nature of what one learns about oneself through overcoming challenges. Because, you know, there's a truism in all sorts of aspects of life that it's when things go wrong that you learn more than when everything goes right. And one imagines that, certainly from your point of view, that that's true. What is it about adversity, do you think, that helps people to unlock, I don't know, aspects of their character, facets of their personality almost, that maybe they didn't even know they had before?
It's an interesting question and one that I continue to seek answers to. I was doing a talk in a company and someone in the audience said, "You clearly read a lot," because I reference a few different books in my talk. Now, the fact that they're pretty much the only books I've ever read, you know, means that I'm not a literary type, but I must come across to this guy as sort of a well-read person. But the books that I'm interested in and the stories that I seem to be interested in are of extreme experiences, kind of crucible moments where people are able to capture them and analyse them and perhaps give a view of what got them through. And in particular, there's the book Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, a Second World War concentration camp experience of great loss and great hope. And the other one that I mentioned is a piece in a book called Good to Great by Jim Collins. And the piece in that book is quite a small part of the book, but it's about a guy called Admiral Stockdale, who was a POW at the height of the Vietnam War. And he goes on to explain that he managed to survive this 8-year experience of being tortured, captured, not knowing if he was going to get out or not, or even survive. And he manages to survive. But the interesting part was that he suggests that the ones who didn't survive were the optimists, because they kept thinking they'd get out by Christmas and Christmas would come and go and then it would be Christmas again and it would come and go and they'd become disappointed, demoralised, and many would die in their cells. And I suppose with a mix of Admiral Stockdale's insights, Viktor Frankl's commentary, and then my own experiences of going blind in 98, paralysed in 2010, I've drawn a lot from their very extreme circumstances and how I might apply their thinking to my circumstances. And I think that both of them are example of realists, not optimists, people who accept the brutal facts and maintain a faith that they'll prevail in the end, or accept the brutal facts and hope that things will be better and kind of run those things in parallel.
Well, it's interesting you cite those examples there, Mark, because they were some things I wanted to ask you about, which I'd seen you mention before. And you've talked also before about this tension, I suppose, between acceptance and hope. And it's interesting to talk about hope not quite in a pejorative way, but it almost is, because you reflect there upon this idea that it can, you know, it's the hope can almost destroy you if it's not, I don't know, somehow pegged to being realistic or being pragmatic and actually getting on and doing. Is that one of the ways that you've managed to strike that balance and address that tension between acceptance and hope in your own, with some of your own struggles and then triumphs?
Yeah, well, I think very, very early on in hospital in 2010, I was really struggling. I spent 6 months just getting from day to day and a further 10 months in hospital trying to make sense of adding the paralysis to the blindness, and who was I going to be? how was life going to be? What was I going to be able to carry on? And very early on, I had a conversation with a very senior, both practicing and academic psychologist linked to the hospital. And he kind of suggested that hoping for a cure had proven to be psychologically damaging. And I was absolutely appalled by this notion. You know, having been inspired by polar explorers pushing the boundaries and eventually getting to the South Pole, some like Scott dying on the way back, the idea that human beings would in some way cancel hope in favour of acceptance or alone, there just seemed to be absolutely no evidence throughout history that cancelling hope was a good idea. And to accept that there is no cure for paralysis, just to accept it on its own without hope was depressing. It was a grim state of affairs. And of course, whenever something extreme, whenever you have a major accident, a catastrophic spinal cord injury, you're not, well, I may speak on behalf of myself rather than the wider population, but I don't think I was really thinking clearly. I think there was anger in there, there was loss, there was certainly grief mixed in with all of this. So I couldn't necessarily see in the beginning that really what he was talking about was that the first step is to accept that you're paralysed, and on that basis you must learn to look after yourself in the wheelchair, you must learn the skills that you can go on to live a full and meaningful life as a paralysed person. And I think what he was warning against, and I'm being the kindest analysis of his comments that I'm doing, I think what he was warning against was people that he had seen over the years who go after a cure, explore the hope side of the equation without doing that first piece, without learning to live life and a meaningful life as a wheelchair user. But my argument was that if you, in an effort not to have people chasing miracles, you cancel hope and put people just into acceptance, then, as I said a moment ago, that is a pretty crushing place to be. And where I have resolved to live my life is, on one hand, accepting the reality that there may not be a cure and there must be a life to be led in a wheelchair. I've got that pinned down. It's very obvious to me that there is a life, and I see lots of wheelchair users living amazing lives. But it is hard. There aren't enough services. Many people around the world have no supports whatsoever. I mean, lots of people struggle to even get a wheelchair. So I think it is a reasonable thing to do to run acceptance and hope in parallel. And the hope side of the equation for me is finding people who are exercised and have the ability to discover cures in university labs and research facilities around the world, and to start to move those out of the labs to make it available to people in clinics all around the world. Robotic legs, electrical stimulation, nerve bridging, optogenetics, all these things, some of which, I mean, optogenetics, you know, I'm struggling to even spell the word, but the great thing is I'm not a scientist. I am hopefully eventually going to be a beneficiary of some of this work.
Well, that leads us very elegantly up to some of the cutting edge work that Mark Pollock Trust is engaged with, Mark. And it is about, exactly as you say there, often this idea of collaboration between areas. I know there have been some telling moments in your own experience where people who are sort of in a way looking at trying to answer some of these very, very difficult questions, and they're almost sort of working kind of in parallel. And maybe part of what the trust does and what you've brought to proceedings is to bring those people together. And that notion of a collaborative approach seems to be something that permeates a lot of your work. I mean, I guess it's in a way a facile question, but can you tell us a bit about why it's so important to get all these different stakeholders together, and maybe tell us a little bit about how you've actually gone about doing that?
Yeah, and look, it is such an important question, and it's something that we must resolve. But I historically have not been a brilliant collaborator myself, because the way I dealt with my blindness, which happened when I was 22, the way I dealt with that was getting back into rebuilding my life after I'd gone blind, getting the blind toolkit, the white stick, the talking computer, my guide dog, Larry, and going and studying, getting a job, but more particularly going back in into the world of sport and into rowing. And looking back now, you know, the imagery of rowing is used as this in ad advertisements and ad campaigns as this great representation of how a collaborative team should operate. And it's a brilliant image, eight people in a boat rowing in unison, rowing as one. But in actual fact, the truth of the matter is that if one of those guys or ladies isn't pulling their weight, isn't training hard enough, isn't pulling the test score results, they're dropped and they're replaced by a better candidate. So I came from a world of sport, which is a collection of people being the best that they can be. And that's quite a harsh world to live in, but that was what I was used to. There was always someone to take your seat, always someone to replace you. Now, in the world of science, technology, and trying to find a cure, something that's never been done in a meaningful way up to this point in history, some of the people that we work with are the only people in the world who pursue this particular strand of research or have made this particular breakthrough. So they're not replaceable. And therefore, to find a way for that person with scarce time, scarce resources, to work with another group of people who have a scarcity of time, a scarcity of resources, is challenging because they may be busy, they may not have the time, they may not have the inclination, although we find generally people do have the inclination to work together. And they're trying their best to be brilliant in, let's say, electrical stimulation of the spinal cord in UCLA, or they're trying to be brilliant at building robots to allow people to stand and walk, like the people in Exobionics in San Francisco. So there were no shortage of what I kind of recognised as the types of people who in a different field would be winning gold medals at the Olympic Games. You know, these sorts of outstanding individuals and outstanding groups focused on one particular area. But what they weren't getting a gold medal in was looking sideways and combining one technology with another technology to create a better solution. And with our complete lack of expertise in their fields, but a desire on the greater prize of just doing what needs to be done to find a cure, we figured that where we could contribute was bringing these different groups together. And, you know, the truth of the matter is it required sitting around a table in a cafe and sometimes in a boardroom and sometimes in a pub or a wine bar or in a restaurant and getting people to talk to each other, getting these brilliant minds to start sparking ideas on what they could do together. And ultimately, we did create a collaboration between those two groups in UCLA in Los Angeles and Exobionics in San Francisco to combine robotic legs and electrical stimulation to result in voluntary movement whilst walking in a robot. I was the first person to do that back in 2014, and we continue to pursue that work.
Let me ask you about that wider pursuit then, Mark. What, in terms of the objectives, I guess one of the kind of key calls to action for the trust and for all these people who are now galvanized to look at this area is to try and fast track a cure for paralysis, and your dream is to deliver that in certainly your lifetime, in all of our lifetimes. What's necessary for that? You mentioned in your last answer about the scarcity of time and a scarcity of resources. Now, I guess the pressures of time is something that even you, with all of your fearlessness, might find rather tricky to change. But resources, you certainly can. Is it a question of almost putting a big number on this and saying to people, look, let's all pull in the same direction and see what we can do?
I've got all sorts of things jumbling around my head to try and give you a short answer on this. But, you know, one of the things we found out fairly recently was that some of these brilliant scientists that we work with, they spend about 20% of their time doing research, and they spend about 80% of their time teaching, going to meetings. Now, not meetings about science necessarily, but meetings about administration, meetings about the direction of the university. So you've got all these incredible people. And the other thing, of course, is they spend a lot of time trying to write grants to get funding, most of which fail. So you got this thing that just doesn't make sense. You know, science seems to be horrifically fragmented, wildly competitive, and that's based on the fact that funding comes whenever you as a scientist publish your paper with your name suitably prominent on the paper. So in a way, even people who work in the same field, they're not doing a huge amount of research, and they're also necessarily in competition, even with their closest allies, perhaps even a PhD student of old, a postdoc who goes off to set up a new lab in a different part of the country or a different country entirely. So the nature of the system is a problem. There's a systemic failure throughout the system, and you're absolutely right with your question. I just wonder that if we set the number big enough, and we've set that number at $1 billion, it's such a large number that it in fact raises the conversation beyond any one lab's individual conversation or one foundation's individual conversation, and in fact moves it to a point where we must have conversations about how we can pool resources to get to where, let's face it, where this particular group of scientists, technologists, investors, foundations, where we all want to get to for the patients who don't have access to any of this stuff while we're stroking our beards wondering how to fix it all. The reality is that people are dying around the world. People are getting pressure sores. People are spending unnecessary time in hospital. So, yeah, we're not in competition with the other foundations. We're actively trying to catalyse collaborations between those foundations and between scientists.
Mark, you described there people who, for example, have no access, and we talked right at the top about people for whom even access to a wheelchair is only a dream, far less access to the sorts of cutting-edge treatments that we've moved on to. How do you not get just really angry about this? And actually, it strikes me from talking to you how extraordinarily sanguine and phlegmatic you remain generally with the personal adversities and challenges that you face. But more broadly, then, when you feel like, and let's face it, you are something of a spokesperson for, you know, a broader demographic, how do you not just get angry? Is it a question of challenging it? Or do you sometimes get frustrated? What happens to Mark Pollock in those moments?
Oh, I get angry, I get frustrated, I'm impatient, I often get emotional. And I, you know, it's a funny thing because I'm a person who now, as we're having this discussion, you know, I have the opportunity to have this conversation with you, and lots of people through your audience will hear it. And I'm discussing about robotic legs and cutting edge research. But I was at a fundraiser ball, and there were Spinal Injuries Ireland, and there were lots of people in wheelchairs there, some of which we have in our programmes, but many we don't. And even those people who were at the fundraising ball, out of the 300 people that there were maybe only 10 or 12 people in wheelchairs. And I think to the people of the people who aren't at the ball, aren't on podcasts, aren't on walking in robotic legs, and in a sense, I am unrepresentative of the true impact of this injury. And I'm constantly trying to balance the legitimacy of exploration, because I think we do need explorers. We do need lots of money, lots of time, lots of expertise put in at the fringes. And then what we need to do is try and find a way of democratizing that technology and those breakthroughs and getting them to people in an affordable fashion so that they can impact the widest possible number of people. So when anger bubbles up inside me, I think to myself, well, you know, for me, at this point in history, in this place in the world, with the backing that I've got, this is about as good as it gets. So, you know, I need to channel my anger into productive effort and push this on and try and make a difference.
Mark, what about the support that you get from other stakeholders in this discussion? And I'm perhaps not talking about partners or corporate partners like UBS. We're talking to you, of course, as one of their global visionaries. What about from nation states, from government? Because we know that in lots of very challenging areas of public life, there's a short-termism. It's understandable in a way from the political classes. You know, they're maybe not going to be around to see the fruits of investment that might pay off in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. Is that a source of frustration too? And do you think that there needs to be a broader willingness for governments in particular to grasp the nettle differently when it comes to challenges of an enormous scale like the ones we're talking about?
Yeah, the conversations with government that we are having, which are not necessarily the same as all of the foundations, there's lots of work to be done on the care side of the equation for services, for accessibility, for carers, for wheelchairs, all of that side of it. So on the cure side of it, what we find is that that government is really represented by the research funding agencies. And in many cases, the research funding bodies are funding universities for breakthrough research to generate IP, that IP to be housed in a spin-out company eventually. And then once the spin-out company starts to attract funding from government agencies, that is in an effort to try and create jobs within the country. And of course, that all makes abundant sense from a country perspective. But what we're talking about is we might have a US robot, and we might have a Swiss nerve bridging technology, and we might have an Australian optogenetics theme. So the question then becomes, how do we galvanize governments, philanthropists, and investors to commercialize companies and generate jobs, generate viable products, and then make them work, or make them cross that what's called the valley of death, so that they become viable products, like some of the robotics companies are managing to do. For me, as a patient, I'm not a scientist, and I'm taking these different technologies and putting them together. Therefore, you don't necessarily own the underlying IP, and therefore that doesn't attract huge funding. But there's enough money in the world, right? There's enough money in the world, and we're approaching it in a slightly different way, and therefore trying to put a value on the impact of collaboration. And that's what we've been working with UBS around. How do we tell that story? How do we demonstrate that the value through collaboration is there? Because the money is there, inside and outside government. We just got to find a way to access it.
Mark, perhaps just finally, can we reflect on, I don't know, on those other moments? Maybe you've had a busy day in the office, or you've been on the fundraising ticket, and you're sort of winding down. I don't know, I get the impression you don't spend much time winding down, but what does that look like? If you're looking to just sort of recharge a bit, where do you go? Or maybe, you know, if you're looking for some quiet time to get some fresh, another layer of inspiration, where do you turn? Do you find that in the pages of books? You said earlier that there's a couple of books that really live with you. Is it a place you go? Is it certain people you talk to? I don't know. Did you charge your glass? What kind of things give you that moment of a bit of respite and maybe a bit of inspiration as well?
Yeah, I found as I've got older, but I'm finding this with all my friends, you know, we've started to become, you know, busier and busier and busier, whether we need to be or not. And I've been, over the summer, the scientist said to me that the best next step that I could do is lose some weight, so that the electrical stimulation doesn't have to find its way through unnecessary fat reserves. So I didn't go out and about for really July or August. I lost 10 kilos, which I didn't think I had to lose, but I was doing all this intermittent fasting and high fat, low carbs. But that's not a sustainable lifestyle for me, because I absolutely do like to go and have a drink. So in September, I was running a September experiment to go out every weekend and have fun and see what that did to my weight. So I was intermittent fasting during the week and having, stereotypically as an Irish person, pints of Guinness at the weekend, watching the rugby and having a good time. So, you know, I think I need to do that because I enjoy it, and it's not work, and it forces me to turn my computer off. But it doesn't lead to what I think we all also need, which is time to think, time to just reflect and sit back and not be doing all the time. And sometimes, well, pretty much all the time, my fiance Simon challenges me to celebrate some of the really meaningful wins that we have along the way. I'm not good at that because I'm always looking at the end of when we're going to fix paralysis, which of course has never been done in history before. So I think I better start taking some time to reflect on the wins that we have along the way. But I do like a pint.
Well, we'll certainly drink to that as well, Mark. Mark Pollock, thanks so much for being on the programme. And that's all for this 220th edition of the Bulletin with UBS here on Monocle 24. You can find out more about the work of Mark Pollock and other global visionaries in the UBS programme. Head to ubs.com and search Global Visionaries. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.